Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock and roll albums.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
I'm Redbeard. Today we go in the studio with a pair of young British musicians who shouted their way to one of the biggest albums of the 1980s.
Have to not appear to be just a couple of dour young men, which is why one say we choose a like Songs from the Big Chair for the second album. I mean, you know, anything to sort of lighten it up a bit. And there's, you know, they're like Head Over Heels been a love song on there, and you know, different things that we just wanted to do and not appear to be so black. Hello, this is Kurt Smith of Tears for Fears in the studio with Songs from the Big Chair.
1985, for the most part, was a year of superstars in popular music, the year in which the headlines and the charts were dominated by names like Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, Prince, and Madonna. More than at any time since the arrival of the Beatles, the comings, goings, and quirks of rock stars were being treated as front-page news, the stuff that People magazine covers were made of. But in the midst of all that celebrity, there was another, quieter phenomenon taking place. It was the sound of two 23-year-old musicians from Bath, England, childhood friends who'd been playing together since they were 13 years old. In 1985, Kurt Smith and Roland Orzabal were the ones who knocked Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA from the top of the charts. They did it under the name Tears for Fears, with an album called Songs from the Big Chair. Bath, England is a small tourist town in the West. When Kurt Smith and Roland Orzabal met there in 1975, they were unhappy adolescents who had two things in common. Both of them had suffered through the divorces of their parents, and both of them were drawn to music as a way to ease their pain. Their bonding was almost immediate, and the shape of their future seemed imminently clear, according to Kurt Smith.
We wanted to be professional musicians. We wanted to do this as a job and make a living from it. Even from the age of 13, there were like four or five songs in the set that were our own. I mean, you know, even though we were doing the Stairway to Heavens as well when we were 13 years old. So we always thought that we would go on. The thing is, we never didn't believe in ourselves. We always thought we had something to say, something to offer. And it just seemed like a natural progression. I don't think we even ever thought about it, to be honest. I mean, we just stepped straight into it.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, frightened to live for their daily races, going nowhere, their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression, have my head, I want to drown my sorrow, no tomorrow, no tomorrow.
Tears for Fears with Mad World, a hit in the UK from their 1983 debut album, The Hurting, and an impressive validation for Roland Orzabal and Kurt Smith's determination to cut their previous bandmates loose.
We had a bit of fun. It didn't last that long because myself and Roland are pretty definite about what we, you know, intend to do, what we want to do. And we ended up disagreeing with the other three members in the band. We were the only people that wrote any music. The other three was constantly outvoting us in the so-called democracy. We just said, you know, forget it. And just broke. I mean, their idea of, how to make it. You've got to tour around Germany in two very small vans and work yourself stupid and get yourself known and get yourself a name around. You know, playing in these horrible little clubs all through Germany and things, and actually humping the gear yourself, going out playing, putting it all back away in the van again at night, driving on somewhere else. It wasn't my idea of making a living, you know. It's far too much like hard work. Myself and Ronald realised, or what we understood to be the way to become successful, or at least to get a record deal, which was to record. You know, with the five-piece band we had were actually very good live, but they're just lousy on record, which is why we never sold any records. Because you don't go into a studio and play live. Very few people can do that.
Kurt Smith says that the band name, Tears for Fears, was chosen at the last minute because they wanted a band name before signing their record deal.
The thing is that we didn't want to get involved in this thing with Polygram whereby they're going to veto what you want to call yourself, because we got into that a bit to start with, and we said we want to call ourselves Tears Fizz. They said this bloody awful name. sounds like Teardrop Explodes. I said, so what? And they actually did a whole bash about they didn't want us to call ourselves Tears for Fears, but we just stood our ground and said, look, this is what we're being called. Take it or leave it, you know, tough if you don't like it. I mean, I don't get all those arguments that they think that having any name can affect your success. It's just such rubbish. I mean, you know, your music always gives you your success or not, as the case may be. I mean, they've been, you know, who would have thought when the Beatles came out? I mean, that's the corniest name you could possibly have, but it doesn't affect anything, does it, really? I mean, Led Zeppelin wasn't exactly a wonderful name either.
Yeah.
Old Shelter became another hit from the Hurting debut in the UK, fitting squarely into the new romantic musical movement there. The phrase Tears for Fears, derived from Arthur Yadov's Primal Scream Therapy, a way to confront childhood trauma that most notably John Lennon explored after the breakup of the Beatles. Here's Kurt Smith.
It came from a book. We get to the heavy side. Called The Prisoners of Pain. It was a book I was reading, and it was a chapter about children's nightmares. And it was effectively saying that children invent monsters to be scared of because they can't admit to themselves, it's too painful to themselves to admit what they're really scared of, which could be parents or your teacher at school or whatever it is. You know, the monster is something you can act out with so that you don't have to accept the real reason why you're scared. The answer to which was, if children were allowed to be more natural, they wouldn't have to be scared of these people that they do become scared of. And it was effectively saying just letting them cry more, you know, letting them be more natural anyway. And so Tears for Fears was tears as a replacement for fears. That's where it came from. It came from that chapter. And it just suddenly sort of came to my mind, Tears for Fears.
I'm
for Fear's Primal Scream-inspired song Shout became the longest-length number one song in the U.S. and U.K. since the Beatles' Hey Jude. Next, Kurt Smith sheds light on many of the big issues tackled by the band. For this and other musician interviews, visit inthestudio.net.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Kurt Smith of Tears for Fears with Redbeard.
Thanks, Kurt. As their debut 1983 title, The Hurting, suggested, the lyrics were not exactly cheerful, nor the subjects lighthearted. The songs were moody and dark, perhaps too dark, according to Tears for Fears' Kurt Smith.
What we did after The Hurting, I like to think of it as a very sincere album, but misunderstood in a lot of ways by a lot of people, I think. They thought it vaguely suicidal, the album, actually, because it was all about pain, and the English don't like to talk about that much, really. The idea was, unless you talk about these things, unless you actually experience them and admit they're going on, then you're never going to feel any better. I mean, you need to exercise these things, make them obvious to other people. Otherwise, you go around with this weight on your shoulders all the time. So that was the idea of the album. And the feeling of going out of that into the next one was that we have to make ourselves more clear. We have to not appear to be just a couple of dour young men, which is why one, say, we choose a title like Songs from the Big Chair for the second album. I mean, you know, anything to sort of lighten it up a bit. And there's, you know, they're like Head Over Heels been a love song on there, and, you know, different things that we just wanted to do and not appear to be so black. Is because I like music to be colourful, albeit different colours throughout an album. You know, there can be black, there can be, you know, bright orange or whatever. It seemed to me that our worry, and after the first album, was that people just considered us black.
The Hurting did quite well in England, producing 3 hit singles there. In fact, it was a commercial success almost every place in the world except America. Kurt Smith has a theory about why that happened.
There are loads of reasons for that. I mean, America is so much more market-orientated in the sense of marketing. There's far more business involved in having hits over there than there is anywhere else, where you can effectively do it just on the strength of your music. That's impossible in America. You need, you know, someone behind you and someone promoting it. You don't do it on strength of music in America, really. But, you know, but once you get there, you become bigger on the strength of your music. I would think, anyway, that's the way I perceive it. You become bigger because it has to be good. Also, you know, I mean, you can fool 1 million people into buying something, but it's a lot harder to fool 10 million, you know.
song Mother's Talk from Songs from the Big Chair reflects the influence of Arthur Yanoff's primal screen theories. Meanwhile, Tears for Fears were able to capitalize on being the second generation MTV stars. Again, Kurt Smith.
I guess it's just a natural progression. We never did anything wonderful with the band we were with. And then suddenly everything came together in those sort of two-year gap where we realized that just the two of us was better, you know, than working with a bunch of other people. It just led to confusion and lack of direction, if anything. Mainly lack of direction, in fact. Because if you're not agreeing on things, I mean, we used to do, you know, comedy songs and things. It's cringe when I think of some of the stuff we used to do.
Upon returning to Bath, they hooked up with Ian Stanley, a part-time keyboard player and full-time carpenter. With Orzabal playing guitar, Smith playing bass, and all of them programming various synthesizers and drum machines, they put together demo tapes, which led to a deal with PolyGram Records. This time, as Kurt explained, he and Roland insisted on complete artistic control.
We had very bad experiences with the first record company because they were lazy and they had these artistic people, these people that were, had artistic control of what we did. They made us wear these suits. They made us do these things, right? So that was it for me and Roland. It was like, forget it. You know, the other three were into that and they were into being told what to do. But we like to sort of have control over the art, really. We insisted on that before we even signed to PolyGram, that we'd have artistic control over anything that happened, from single sleeves to videos to whatever. And that was more important to us than the advance we were getting.
Thank you.
real gem on Tears for Fears' sophomore album, that's The Working Hour. Interestingly, Kurt Smith admits that Tears for Fears' first U.S. hit, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, almost didn't make the album.
Yeah, it was the last thing we did. We had seven tracks, and we needed an eighth track. And we had the choice of three different songs. Everybody was one of them. And the reason we did it was because our producer insisted, really. He just loved the rhythm of it. It really didn't have much sort of else there, apart from the rhythm and a bit of melody. But it just had a great feel to it, you know, dum 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 dum. And our producer's going, shuffle, yeah, it's a shuffle, okay, that's a big hit in America, that's a big hit. He hadn't even heard the song, he just heard the beat, so that'll be a hit, you know. Yeah, and there's me and Ronan go, can you say that? So I heard the rhythm first, and then Ronan sat at the piano with the chords and just sang it and said, do you feel comfortable singing this? I said, yeah, I feel comfortable singing that. So we said, okay, well, let's do this. So we did it in about a week and a half, just top to finish.
One.
Everybody Wants to Rule the World was Tears for Fears' breakthrough in North America and around the world, their first number one song in the States. Still to come, their first American tour, hauling around a grand piano, Canadian teenage girls, bumping off the boss, and playing the Hollywood Bowl. For more, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio for the of Tears for Fears number one seller, Songs from the Big Chair.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Kurt Smith of Tears for Fears with Redbeard.
Thanks again, Kurt. On their way to selling over 10 million copies worldwide. Wow. Here's bass player, singer Kurt Smith.
Before we'd even got to America to play, a week before we got to America to play, it went to number one. So we never actually played in America before, live. And our first date in Hartford, Connecticut was, we had a number one single, so it was wild. It was good fun. We were actually doing the video for Head Over Heels in Toronto at the time when we found out. I was asleep, I was woken up. Yeah, well, everyone was in England waiting, you know, everyone's sort of wives and all this sort of stuff and all these people. So we were hot on the phone to England. They had the hugest party here and we had to work.
The third hit from Songs from the Big Chair, Head Over Heels, featured the prominent sound of a sparkling grand piano. Again, Kurt Smith with me in the studio.
We were just getting bored with synthesizers. We wanted to use more real instruments on this record than the first one, which is all synthesizers. And when we played live, we just, you know, we'd started playing after the first album, you know, with a grand piano on stage, just to give, because that's a wonderful feel live, a grand piano, you know. And well, there's something also very pompous about a grand piano, you know. It's grand, you know. It's a you know, it's a big thing. You know, what we thought we're going to put this figure on, you know, da, 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 da. So you imagine it on sax, no, you know. Imagine it on sort of little synthesizer going pee, 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 pee. You think, nope. You think octaves on a grand piano, bow, down, down. And so sort of, that's how it came about. It was just the biggest thing we could find. It was just sort of, yeah. And it's clear as well. It's not as if we had to mix in 10 different sounds to get that sort of strong sound. I think that's the beauty of a grand piano. It can fill something up without you actually having to put down 10 tracks of something, you know, to make something equally as big. We had a great time in America. We'd just come through Canada, and the first album was successful in Canada. That was a bit wilder, purely because, I don't know, for some reason there were sort of a lot more young girls there and stuff. And it's the only time in my entire career I've actually had my shirt ripped off my back and couldn't leave my hotel room and stuff. But always in America, always found them so incredibly polite, you know, and always sort of, I still find them incredibly polite, actually, the general person in the street. I mean, in New York, when I'm in New York, having, you know, now I've got an apartment there, the only time people just come up and say, hey, you're Kurt from Tears for Fears, aren't you? How are you doing? When's the new record coming out? Sorry to bother you. And I'm saying, well, I'll come out at the end of the year. He says, good luck. And they just walk on. Or I just get people walking. I get this quite a lot. People just walk past and go, love your music, and walk straight on by. Which is wild. I mean, I like that. You know, people in general in America are very polite. They don't get as abusive as English people can get, you know. I mean, if you get sort of a couple of drunken Englishmen and they recognise you, I mean, it's a nightmare. Oh, cheers for me. Hey, shout, shout. And like, you're in the middle of this pub hiding under a table. You know? You never get that in America. What we got for this one show, because it's the biggest show we'd ever played by a long chalk, and it sold out in something like 3 hours or something ridiculous, because 90% of the sales of the first album, The Hurting in America, were actually just in Los Angeles. For some reason, they loved us in Los Angeles, just there. Anyway, so for this one date, we thought, make it special. You know, we've never played it before, and they've been waiting for like 4 years to watch us. We hired these three helicopters, and we always played Listen incredibly loudly over the speakers before we came on, which is pretty cosmic experience anyway, you know, to have it, these huge speakers playing this wonderful piece of music. The music starts listening, so, you know, all the bit at the beginning, and then the three helicopters just rose up above this hill, and they all had spotlights in them, and they were all shining them all over the audience and just hovering around. It was wonderful. I was standing on the stage. I mean, no one took any notice of me standing on stage. It was just great to watch. Just all it was. Sort of very ethereal music going on, these three sort of eerie looking lights hovering in the sky, shining over people.
Thank you.
Tears for Fears and Songs from the Big Chair, the number one album in the world.